Good afternoon. You've tuned into Faith and Reason. It's your host, Dr. John Pinero. On Faith and Reason, we like to explore all varieties of topics related to the Catholic intellectual tradition and how that tradition can impact your daily lives. And so I'm very glad you tuned in to Holy Family Radio today. We have as our guest Dr. Benjamin Lockard of Grand Valley State University. Dr. Lockard is professor of English there and was formerly president of the T.S. Eliot Society. And it's the poet and cultural critic Eliot that we'll be talking about on the program today. Dr. Lockard is author of Ethereal Rumors, T.S. Eliot's Physics and Poetics, published in 1998, as well as The Sacred Marriage, Psychic Integration and the Fairy Queen, published in 1987. He writes an annual review of Eliot's scholarship for American Literary Scholarship and is most recently the editor of the collection of essays for Fairleigh Dickinson University Press, T.S. Eliot and Christian Tradition. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
And I should say also Ben and I are friends and opera buddies of sorts, so we'll try not to talk too much about opera today. We'll try to stick to Eliot.
Yes, but we do have tickets together for the production of Carmen in a couple of weeks.
And looking forward to that. So now, Dr. Lockard, I should say at the outset, is going to be at Aquinas College for our Catholic Studies Colloquium on April 9th. And he'll be talking about both T.S. Eliot and Christopher Dawson and how their views relate to religion and culture. And I think we'll be getting into that topic sometime today, but just want to make sure I don't forget to mention that. Now, most of our listeners will know something about Eliot, and maybe they've read bits of the Four Quartets or The Wasteland or know the final closing words of the Wasteland. And they might also know that he was a Christian, but not a Catholic. And so I think it's a good place to start, really, the program, just saying, who was T.S. Eliot? Just kind of give us a brief sketch of the man before we get into his thinking about religion and culture and politics that we can see through his many essays, but also his poetry.
Yes, Eliot came from an old New England family. One of his ancestors emigrated to the colonies back in the 1600s, and he came from a little town called East Coker, which Eliot later went on to write about in one of the Four Quartets, his great religious poem of his later years. So, and in that poem, he says, "In my end is my beginning." He felt that he was going back to the origins of his family in returning to England and becoming an English citizen. But he was raised in the States. His grandfather, William Greenleaf Eliot, moved from New England to St. Louis, out on the frontier in those days, and established a Unitarian church there. The family had become Unitarian, and Eliot was raised in a Unitarian congregation, which was headed by his grandfather. His grandfather also was involved in the founding of Washington University there in St. Louis, and his family was very public-minded, public-spirited, and they were involved in many public projects in the city, but most notable, I would say, is Washington U. If you go to that campus and you cross under the entryway, there's a brass plaque in the floor tiles to William Greenleaf Eliot.
Was there a vital intellectual culture in St. Louis at the time? Sometimes frontier outposts are very frontiersy, and a young intellectual type like Eliot might not have such a good time there.
It was somewhat limited at that time. It wasn't the big city that we know today, certainly. And I think part of his family's mission was to establish more of an intellectual atmosphere in the city. The other major the other major American writer who came out of St. Louis was Tennessee Williams. They didn't know each other, I don't. Eliot grew up there, and in one of the Four Quartets, he writes very briefly about the river. He says, "I do not know very much about gods, but I think the river is a strong brown god." And those are the powerful opening lines of the Dry Salvages, one of the four quartets. So he held that upbringing in his heart and always thought of himself as an American in some way. But he went on to college at Harvard University. His family was so prominent back east that when he was a student at Harvard, the president of Harvard was an Eliot, a distant cousin.
Really?
So gives you some idea of how influential his family was.
I'm sure it was entrance exams, though, that got him into Harvard.
Well, he was a pretty bright fellow.
Yeah,
he wouldn't have had any difficulty getting in there. Yeah. He didn't need any pull. But an extremely well-read young man, very serious student. And so he, in any case, he grew up in this Unitarian religious atmosphere. It's about as far from Catholicism as you can get, as you know. It's a non-creedal faith. They don't. You're not required to believe in anything to be a Unitarian. But in those days, Unitarians were generally thought of themselves as Christians, and certainly his family thought of themselves as Christians. Still, it was a shock to them when years later he joined the Anglican Church in England. And not only did he join the Church of England, but the kind of the most conservative traditionalist branch of that church, the Anglo-Catholic movement. You know, the Anglicans speak of low church, broad church, and high church, but even beyond high church, which is the more ritualistic branch of the Anglican communion, was this movement of Anglo-Catholicism. It was really associated with the Tractarian movement at Oxford in the 1800s, which produced John Henry Newman, among others. And, of course, Newman went over to the Roman Catholic Church. He poped, as they say there, or crossed the Tiber.
But some of those in the Oxford movement didn't, right? So those are those who remain or who latch onto this ritualism later, that's the Anglo-Catholics.
Exactly. And it was a pretty dynamic movement at the time when Eliot was there in the early 1900s or the teens and 20s. He converted to the Church of England in 1927. So at that time, the Anglo-Catholic movement was very strong, very prominent. It was growing, and there was some sense that it might really become central to the Church of England. And of course, that's not the way history went. And now it's a pretty small movement, though it still exists. In fact, there's an Anglo-Catholic church here in Grand Rapids, out on Lake Michigan Drive.
Now let's see, 1927. That's what, maybe 5, 6, 7 years, somewhere there, before the Lambeth Conference,
right?
Mm-hmm. And so it was in
31 or 32.
Okay,
I think.
So now at Lambeth, was that seen as Mm-mm. That's kind of the great compromise, isn't it, to the Church of England with the modern world and what ends up being kind of in a very negative way for the Church of England and its growth.
Yeah, of course, notoriously it was the conference where the Anglican bishops approved the use of birth control, the first Christian communion ever to do that.
What did Eliot think about that? Well, he's a recent convert.
Yes, he was a recent convert and a very serious and zealous one. And he did actually write an article in response to the Lambeth conference, where he hit a middle ground. He was quite critical of the Anglican bishops. And he said, you know, maybe we should listen to what the Pope has to say on some of these issues. But at the same time, he said he drew back from Roman Catholic approach to these issues, especially the birth control issue, and said in the end of that essay that perhaps there's a virtue to the Anglican wishy-washiness. He called he didn't use that term, but he was essentially calling it a wishy-washy answer to these questions, but he said that might have a virtue to it. And I think that's part of what kept him in the Church of England. Also, he had become a British citizen at the same time, and so for him, the church, his church affiliation and his citizenship were connected to some extent.
Was, do you think he was an American trying so hard to be English that he opted for the Church of England?
Yes.
I mean, would we, I don't know how we would know that. I, as an historian, I always hesitate to psychoanalyze the dead, but I'm curious.
No, I mean, people have suggested that. I suppose I'm suggesting that a little bit myself, but I do want to give him more credit for his decision than that. I don't think it's quite so superficial. But again, as I said, he saw himself as returning to his family's traditions back in England, and that was very important to him. So he went back past their Unitarian stage.
And that's quite a—that's a long way to go from Unitarian to Anglo-Catholic. It's as far as you can get before you become Roman Catholic.
Absolutely, he came pretty close. Actually, in 1926, the year before he joined the Church of England, he was in Rome with his wife and his brother and sister-in-law. They went to visit St. Peter's, and when he entered the church, he fell to his knees in front of the Pietà. And so that was a shocking thing for his brother, who was still, of course, in the Unitarian church. And they didn't know what to make of it.
The power that beauty has in a very direct way.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a dramatic moment. But and I think some people who've studied this have said if he had ended up in France, which he would have, which was a possibility too, because he spent a year in France and loved it there. If he had ended up there, pretty sure he would have become Roman Catholic. But
now, how did? Now, he was already an established poet, wasn't he, by that time? So how did his readers or other people, other poets of his day, how did they respond to his conversion?
Many of them were dismayed. You know, he was very famous. The Wasteland had been written 5 years earlier and had made him famous. And people thought of him as an avant-garde poet, which he was, in style anyway. And they thought of him as one of the new generation that was moving away from the mores of the past. And they were really pretty shocked when he made that move. In fact, Virginia Woolf wrote to her sister in a letter and said, "Tom is lost to us forever."
Wow.
Actually, she remained friends with him, a very faithful friend of his. But at that moment, that was her first response.
And then there were others. I'm sure you'll know this story. G.K. Chesterton was originally quite critical of The Wasteland, wasn't he? I mean, he didn't see some of the things that I've heard you talk about in various places, like the Russell Kirk Center and in other lectures about the deep Christian nature of that poem. And many people didn't see that, including the usually astute Chesterton, at least not for a few years. Is that am I correct?
That's
in
true.
It that way?
Yeah, that's true. I think it's true for C.S. Lewis as well. But mostly, I think they didn't like his style of poetry. They were writing more traditional in more traditional poetic forms, and
well, certainly Chesterton.
Yeah. Yeah. So it just didn't line up very well with the style of their own verse, and I suppose there was a little bit of animosity because Eliot was so instantly famous and have it just catapulted beyond them as poets, as a poet. So who knows? But they later, Lewis and Eliot eventually became friends, though not close friends. And when Chesterton died, Eliot, who had said some somewhat negative things about him too and had kept his distance from Chesterton, Eliot wrote a very warm tribute to Chesterton on his death. Yeah.
Okay. Now, would as Eliot is someone who, as a poet and as a new English subject, they say citizens or subjects. I usually tend to say subject,
but subject
I guess
it's right term.
Probably
yes.
The right term. But
he did declare himself a monarchist too.
Yeah,
so.
as a new Englishman. What would he have self-identified in any way with the term conservative what he was trying to conserve, or traditionalist? Was there was there a term or a group of people that Eliot would fit in with? I think about all the people around the intellectual world of that time, with everybody from Christopher Dawson to G.K. Chesterton. You have these Catholics, and then you have Eliot and and others, and maybe even transatlantic. But who's who's he falling in with, and how do you think of himself beyond an Anglo-Catholic
yes,
poet?
I'm trying to think, and I don't recall his calling himself a conservative very often, but that's what he identified with. He thought of himself as conservative. His family was politically conservative, even though they were part of that rather radical Protestant church. And he picked that up from them, and though he rejected their Unitarianism, he kept their conservatism. So I don't think he ever was tempted towards the liberal political views.
Yeah, I think in that the liberal democratic era, you'd almost have to be conservative to become a monarchist.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Sure.
And he came in at Harvard. He came under the influence of Irving Babbitt, who was a very dynamic teacher by all accounts, and Babbitt was pushing against the liberal approach to life and against well, Rousseau was his whipping boy.
So what was the liberal approach to life? What is –
Well, what Babbitt said was that the liberal was a humanitarian and a utilitarian. The liberal thought and I think liberals still think this, that that they can improve human life by certain government programs. And and all they need to do is to improve the material level of human life. This is where the kind of utilitarian approach comes in. The Benthamite idea that what you're aiming for is the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. Babbitt rejected that, and he taught Eliot to reject that. He said that humanitarianism is a dead end because it's committed to this naturalistic view of the human person, and it doesn't take any account of the soul, of the spirit of the human person. It treats people as beasts, really. So even though it goes under the name humanitarian, it doesn't deal with the whole human person. So that's what he picked that up as a college student from Irving Babbitt, and also from Babbitt's friend Paul Elmer Moore. Those two called themselves the New Humanists, and they were searching for something that went beyond this kind of materialistic, naturalistic liberalism.
Were they Christian men?
Well, not exactly. And Eliot later broke with them when he became a Christian. He found that there was a definite limitation to the new humanism too. So he wrote an essay on Babbitt after his conversion, and he said the humanitarian approach doesn't work. Neither does the new humanist approach. If there's no God involved, then ultimately you aren't going to deal with the depths of the human heart.
These ideas could, of course, sprung full-blown from Eliot himself, but who else is he reading? Who are his important inspirations, you think, in arriving at some of these conclusions? Before we get to how we see these in his poetry, but it's Eliot's a fascinating figure to me because he's got this conservative disposition towards tradition in so many ways, but the form of his poetry is anything but. And fascinates Eliot scholars as well. But in the meantime, who's he reading? Where is he getting these
well,
ideas then?
Babbitt introduced him to the writings of a French author called Charles Maurras, who was very significant at that time in France and was leading a traditionalist movement in France. Then Eliot spent a year in Paris, 1910-1911, and he came under the influence of Maurras even more at that time. But that was a temporary influence because Maurras was a Catholic but he was more interested in bringing back royalism, in bringing back the monarchy to France. And he wasn't a practicing Catholic. He identified himself with Catholicism, but he was actually an atheist. And eventually the Pope put his books on the index. And
now, why would – I don't understand that type of identification. So purely cultural, almost tribal, and that's he can't imagine France without a king or without the church, but he – no assent to belief on his own. He just can't do it.
That's exactly right. He thought traditionalism was the answer, but just as a useful tool.
He's a consequentialist, isn't he? I mean, that's right. So the religion's it's that's good it. As part of the national identity.
Yeah.
But if it's so I'm always puzzled by that. So that the truth claims then don't matter. So then I think that's the next step in 20th century nihilism. I guess then why bother, really?
Yeah, I think you're right. And Eliot eventually came to that conclusion too, of course, because when he was in France, he came under the influence also of a group of writers connected with the Nouvelle Revue Française that and there was a kind of Catholic renewal going on among intellectuals in France at that time. And so that really drew Eliot in. He was very close to some of those young writers. And he also then at that time came under the influence of Jacques Maritain. And Maritain was just coming into his own at that time as well. More or less the same age as Eliot, or maybe a slightly older, and he influenced Eliot quite a bit. The Maritain, I've got just one line from Maritain here. He said that if you completely separate the church from the state, it simply spells suicide. And that kind of political view, if it is a political view, a cultural view, I guess I would call it, came to influence much Eliot much more than the thinking of Maurras did.
Was he a political creature, Eliot? I mean, was he engaged too much in what we'd call politics, the decision-making progress, which we do through legislation and debate and that sort of thing?
He wasn't particularly. He thought about politics a lot and wrote about politics quite a bit. And he edited a journal for about 15 years called The Criterion, and wrote commentaries in The Criterion, and that's where most of his political statements are. He was doing that journal between the wars, 1922 to 1939, I guess it was, and he stopped production of the journal just on the eve of World War II. So there's where his political commentary was, but I'd like to mention a talk that he gave later in life in 1955 called The Literature of Politics, where he said that what he practiced was a pre-political thinking. He said that he wanted to try to let me give you this quotation. He said, "There should always be a few writers preoccupied in penetrating to the core of the matter, in trying to arrive at the truth and to set it forth, without too much hope, without ambition to alter the immediate course of affairs, and without being downcast or defeated when nothing appears to ensue." So he saw himself as a political philosopher, perhaps, though he didn't give himself such a high title, and didn't think the thinking that he was doing would necessarily have any immediate effects. And he didn't get involved in the issues of the moment to any great degree. He identified with, he says explicitly in this talk, he identified with Reinhold Niebuhr in America and with Christopher Dawson in England. And he said the fundamental question that the pre-political thinker asks is, what is man? You start with that question, and then your political views flow from it.
So you mentioned Christopher Dawson, whom we'll talk about in a moment. Who is the other gentleman?
Reinhold Niebuhr.
And Reinhold Niebuhr.
Mm-hmm.
So then what we're talking about here is somebody like Eliot is taking a look at modern civilization and asking questions about culture and discovering, of course, that culture cannot be changed overnight. So he certainly would never classify or call himself an activist with these works, but he takes a very long view that you need an intellectual class of people, at least criticizing culture then and thinking these things, and maybe even writing poetry and producing art that might not have effects for a very long time. Is that?
Yes, I think that's right. And then I mentioned that he came under the influence of Maritain, but I think it's Dawson who really influenced his view of culture and religion the most. They were contemporaries, and Dawson wrote a number of books in the 1930s, shortly after Eliot's conversion. All those books were reviewed in Eliot's journal. Eliot invited Dawson to write articles for the journal. So they never became close personal friends, but they corresponded with each other and read each other's books and influenced each other in their thinking. Mm-hmm. But I would say the influence on political, cultural issues went more from Dawson to Eliot, because Dawson was such a deep thinker on these issues.
Dawson is one of the his work is really what underlies not only the Catholic Studies program I directed at Aquinas College, but Don Briel's famous program at the University of St. Thomas and others. That is this sense that religion begets culture, and so that the important things of life, or other things in life, I should say, even flow from that. So politics would be one of them. So we never turn to politics then to shape culture. Somehow, you know, these things go the other way.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe I'll start with go back to Eliot here. But this is saying the same things that Dawson did. But Eliot says that the first important assertion is that no culture has appeared or developed except together with a religion. There just hasn't – no culture has developed without a religion, and the idea of developing a culture without a religion is absurd. He says that the culture is essentially the incarnation, so to speak, of the religion of a people. And I like that phrase.
This is Eliot?
This is Eliot. He says the culture is an incarnation of the religion, and I think that's very beautifully put, and of course in theological terms, that the religion, the spiritual quest of the people, informs their culture. So that's what's important, and you have to nurture that traditional religious culture if you want a healthy society.
So what makes us a community then is our approach to the transcendent order that we sense exists in the universe. And so Dawson studied pagan cultures, non-Christian cultures, Christian cultures. And Dawson was, of course, Catholic. Eliot was not. Let's explore the connection between Dawson and Eliot a bit more. I mean, I know this is what you'll be talking about at Aquinas College. So I know you've been doing plenty of thinking on that. Do we see that? Let's talk about the poetry for a bit. I mean, places that we might see that connection between Dawson and Eliot coming out in Eliot's poetry. This understanding of culture and how a culture can be sick, and what happens when it's no longer connected to its religion, or it's trying to form a wholly new culture or build upon a non-religion or irreligion or no religion, an ideology, in other words. Mm-hmm. Because this seems to be the post-World War I project here in the West, isn't it? To try to build a world order not based on religion, and it doesn't seem to work very well. And I think it's because Dawson seems to read humanity right. Mm-hmm. I think, as well as Eliot.
Exactly right. And this is a line from a lesser known poem of Eliot's called The Rock. It was actually a pageant play that he wrote, and in one of the choruses to that play, the speaker says, "They constantly try to escape from the darkness outside and within by dreaming of systems so perfect that no one will need to be good." Hmm. I love that line. They're dreaming of systems so perfect that no one will need to be good. This is, in fact, the modern secularist liberal agenda to come up with a system that will and enhance human life without requiring people to be virtuous.
Yeah. I mean, virtue would be unnecessary, right? The system takes care of itself.
Right. If you just give them a good home and enough food and so on, they'll be virtuous, you know.
What's the context there? Is that 1940s and fascism, communism. What's in his mind, do you think?
I think it is both communism and fascism. And he and Dawson were both opponents of both of those radical ideologies. In fact, both of them said at one time and another that that if you don't have religion, you're going to have some ideology as a religion substitute. For example, I love this line of Dawson's in a book called Religion and Culture, written in the 30s. He says, when the prophets are silent and society no longer possesses any channel of communication with the divine world, the way to the lower depths is still open, and man's frustrated spiritual powers will find their outlet in the unlimited will to power and destruction. So I think that just about captures it. You know, you close off the channel to the higher divine world, but the channel to the lower world of destructive urges is still wide open. And that's what you get with communism and fascism. Dawson one time gave a paper at a conference. It was held in Italy, but I think it was Goering himself was a participant at the conference, and Dawson gave a speech about, and he mentioned that Germany would not be, would be greatly impoverished if it hadn't had Jewish people.
Wow. do we know Goering's response?
He was called away from the conference because it was just when the Nazi Party came to power.
Oh, I see.
So he was actually called away to go back and start running the country.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But Dawson spoke truth to them at that point. And, Dawson said in another book of his, that the essential characteristic of National Socialism is to be found in its attempt to create an ideology which will be the soul of the new state. So he explicitly says this Nazi ideology attempts to become the religion of that people.
So there's going to be an idolatrous aspect to any ideology. So with fascism, it's the state, then, in the place of God, I guess, and trying to shape culture toward that end. And the Nazi Party was very good at doing that through textbooks, and it really didn't take too long, it seems, for that to work in Germany. Now, fascism elsewhere, I know there were critics of some traditionalist Catholics at the time who seemed to have a fondness for Franco in Spain, and maybe for Mussolini in Italy. Mussolini, of course, the person who embarked upon fascism and took the imagery from the old Roman world, and Adolf Hitler calling, of course, his brand National Socialism, and drawing a distinction there. But did Eliot see anything in that Southern European style of fascism that was certainly very different than the Germanic version, but at least in Spain, very, very protective of the church and of a monarchical, at least a type of monarchy? Was he in that kind of mixed group that has its critics even today, which includes Hilaire Belloc, some would say, and G.K. Chesterton, and others would level these accusations. I don't think they're all appropriate, but the accusations are there.
Well, he did run into that issue because there was a petition that went round for intellectuals to sign at some point related to the situation in Spain. And Eliot refused to sign it. He said, I'm just not taking sides on this, and because I don't – I'm not sure that either side is worthy of support. So he backed away from that, and he got quite a bit of criticism. And people then started to label him as pro-fascist. But he never was. I mean, he was always critical of the fascist ideology wherever he saw it, whether in Germany, Spain, or Italy. And just wasn't tempted by it. Many of his friends were, of course, famously Ezra Pound. Pound was a very close friend of Eliot's, and he was a lifelong fan of Mussolini. was arrested after the war, tried for treason because of his broadcasts, his radio broadcasts for the for Mussolini during the war. And actually, Elliot and other friends helped get him out of prison, and the U.S. Authorities released him, and he went back to Italy. And when he got back on Italian soil, he gave the fascist salute. So he was unrepentant,
yeah,
right?
To the like it. Repentant just enough to get out of the pen.
Right.
And then, yeah, sure.
So, but Elliot just wasn't, he was very wise in that way, I think. And again, this was part of his pre-political approach to it. He tried to step back and take a more philosophical view. And he said that the thing that really, that we don't recognize in these movements over on the continent is that we have something in common with them to the extent that we too are materialists. He said that's what we need to look at in our own house is, do we have a softer version of materialism that's driving us? So he wasn't uncritical of the British and American situations at the time.
And that's the job of a cultural critic. It's the exact job of the kind of people he thinks every society needs, it sounds like. Now, would in his thinking on fascism or his refusal then to sign that, there's, oh gosh, a lot of people over the years are criticized for what things they didn't do as opposed to things they did do. One thinks of Pius XII, most famously, who's got a lot of critics for allegedly not doing enough about the Holocaust, and then you have to look at, well, what did he do? What could he have done? All these kinds of questions, right? Elliot in this idea of pre-political thinking, then, so he's not going to put his faith in any political movement, then, certainly, but in his connection to English history and his Anglo-Catholicness and the monarch then as head of that church, what did he think? What did he think in looking across the pond at America of just these plethora of religions and the freedom of religion? There was several popes in the 19th century criticized liberalism and criticized freedom of religion for not being freedom of religion, but being cloaking religious indifferentism. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be bearing fruit by the 1910s and 1920s. Well, even in England, I think, but in elsewhere, that is religious indifferentism masquerading as just freedom.
Yes,
you know, freedom of choice. Did he ever comment on that?
Yes, Elliot was very critical of that, and he really thought that America was a lost cause in this regard. because he wrote a small book called Notes Towards the Definition of Culture, where he talked about the necessary integration of religion and culture. And he said, when you have a situation like that in America where there's such a proliferation of sects, it makes it very difficult for religion to remain integral to the culture.
And Christianity in general is some kind of umbrella, Protestant and Catholic. That's not good enough.
He had his doubts. You know, he was really, and again, I think this is one reason he adhered to the Church of England. He thought it was good to have a church that was dominant in a certain country. He said at one point, however bigoted the announcement may sound, the Christian can be satisfied with nothing less than a Christian organization of society.
Wow. But there's a certain, you know, as a historically speaking, I mean, didn't history prove that opinion wrong in the sense that when we look around in the Western world for the most religious country, now it depends on what we mean by West. We could bring in Poland, and maybe the United States would lose, perhaps.
Maybe.
Out in this, but maybe. Uh-huh. You know, every day things change.
Uh-huh.
But the United States is this anomaly to most Europeans that even as secular as we might think it is, you toss a European into America and they think it's the most religious country they've been in ages, and they think we're so obviously Christian. Why would we even doubt whether we're a Christian country or how Christian the Commonwealth is? And thinking of everybody from Alexis de Tocqueville to other admirers of the freedom of religion in America, that somehow it's the freedom of religion that's allowed that to happen. And it seems mm-hmm. it seems to go against this thinking that you need a unified church or one faith, one king, right. as Louis XIV once said.
Right. And I think Eliot would acknowledge that he was maybe a little off on that. And even at the time, I just quoted his saying that you couldn't be satisfied with less than a Christian organization of society. But then he immediately adds, but that's not the same thing as a society consisting exclusively of devout Christians.
Okay.
So he wasn't trying to purge mm-hmm. people who weren't right. Members of the church. He recognized that you had to have religious freedom.
And that's a cultural question, isn't it? So the majority of your population is on the same page about the big transcendent questions about the good life and community and the purpose of man, and that I think Dawson had said a Christian culture is not a perfect society, right? It's a culture composed of Christians who really mean it and intentionally try to live that out, and then you see it in their economic arrangements and their political arrangements and their art and their architecture and all of those things that they grow out of religion.
Yes. And both Dawson and Eliot were clear that you couldn't go back to a medieval synthesis of religion and culture. So they believed in a separation of church and state after a fashion. They just didn't want it to mean that the church didn't have any say in things.
So turning back the clock, they wouldn't. Yeah. They don't think it's possible to relive Christendom.
No, in fact, Dawson says it is today impossible to return to the undifferentiated unity of medieval culture. Mm-hmm. And Eliot says the Christian society that he's envisioning can neither be medieval in form nor be modeled on the 17th century or any previous age. You have to come to terms with the situation that you find yourself in. In fact, Eliot says that we know from our reading of history that a certain tension between church and state is desirable. Mm-hmm. When the church and state fall out completely, it is ill with the commonwealth. And when the church and state get on too well together, there's something wrong with the church. So they envisioned a dynamic tension between church and state where the church wouldn't be just marginalized but wouldn't also they weren't aiming for a theocracy.
Sure. And even during the height of Christendom in the 13th century, particularly in England but elsewhere, the state, even the Christian monarchs, give or take the occasional canonized monarch here or there. They're always pushing against the church for legal prerogatives that were part of the church and that, you know, and they want. They're always pushing against the church. If they're not pushing against the church, they're pushing against the nobility, whatever the other power structures are. And I think we even see that today. I think the Affordable Health Care Act is a great example of when you have some countervailing power and it's traditional and it's huge and it's enormous like the Catholic Church and it's mm-hmm. involved in the adoption and health care and you want to control every aspect of human life. You got to go after that big countervailing institution, right? You can't allow that to coexist.
Right.
And you're going to do it in a variety of ways, maybe through birth control, whatever you think will split the Christian community. You start yeah. there and go on.
Yeah, exactly. And so you know, I think that they had Dawson and Eliot had a really wise vision of church and state that would be counterbalanced to each other. And but not one dominant over the other. Obviously, the Obama administration has a different vision.
Yeah, obviously.
But Dawson and Eliot also didn't think that if you could achieve their vision, you would have a perfect society, as you said a minute ago. And in fact,
that's the progressivists or the liberals' vision.
Yeah,
you can have a perfect society on Earth. That's the ideologue.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to turn your Christian conservatism into yet another ideology, mm-hmm. which both of them feared. In fact, I like this statement of Eliot's very much. He says, it's very easy for speculation on a possible Christian order in the future to tend to come to rest in a kind of apocalyptic vision of a golden age of virtue. But we have to remember that the kingdom of Christ on earth will never be realized, and also that it is always being realized. we must remember that whatever reform or revolution we carry out, the result will always be a sordid travesty of what human society should be.
Mm-hmm. So always falling short.
That's the best we could come up with.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, but this is Dr. John Pinero. You're listening to Holy Family Radio, and the show is Faith and Reason. I'm talking with Dr. Ben Lockhart of Grand Valley State University, noted Elliott Scholar, and noted very much in the Grand Rapids community for quite some time. I think in the last 10, 15 minutes of the show here, maybe we'll turn to and talk about Elliott's poetry in particular. I think more people will be, when they think of a poet, they think of poetry and not cultural critique via essays, as we've been talking about. So if I'm a Catholic and I want to read Elliott, and he's Anglo-Catholic, he's not Roman Catholic, but you know what, there's a lot there that will speak to me about Christ and culture and how these things are related. And you were talking about, you didn't use the term, but Augustinian dualism and mm-hmm. so many things. Where would I want to start if I'm not that familiar with Elliott beyond having heard the name?
Well, it's hard to start on Elliott because he is such an avant-garde writer. His style is difficult. And
you have to enroll in one of your classes?
That's a good thing to do. And I can't say that I'm always successful either in conveying what I think is there. But you start by just reading. When I first read Elliott when I was 19 years old, and I thought, you know, I don't really understand this, but it's poetry. I think it's beautiful. It's got a certain power to it. And I've felt that ever since, that mm-hmm. it's difficult, but it's also musical in its own way and worth reading. So, you know, pick it up and read. His reputation rests primarily on two big poems, The Wasteland, written before his conversion, and The Four Quartets, written after. And so those are the poems to grapple with. I think that a Christian reader, a Catholic reader, would probably find The Four Quartets much more approachable and readable.
The faith is more explicit?
It is more explicit, and the style is less jumpy. The Wasteland mm-hmm. just bounces from one thing to another. It's a jagged, fragmented style. At the end of the poem, he says, these fragments I have shored against my ruin. Mm-hmm. And I think he's thinking about the fragments of the poem. It never maintains a narrative for more than a few lines before jumping to something else. So that makes it difficult. And I think that I would say to somebody first picking up The Wasteland that this is a poem in which the young writer was looking at the world around him and finding it empty, finding that something was missing. And that's why he speaks of it as a wasteland. It's a cultural wasteland where people's lives are sterile. There's very little love in it, and there's very little life in this modern world that he's depicting in the poem. So it's a depressing poem, but towards the end of The Wasteland, the last section of The Wasteland is called What the Thunder Speaks, What the Thunder Said. And the thunder speaks in Sanskrit, but what it says is give, sympathize, and control. To give to other people, to sympathize with other people, and to control yourself, to exercise self-control. So you finally get some good advice, I would say, from the voice of the thunder at the end of The Wasteland. And it seems to me that there is in that final section a turn towards the positive, or at least towards the redemptive. In fact, it's in that final section that Christ himself appears, though in disguise. And again, this is before his conversion, and scholars debate about whether you can...
Conversion is a long, complex thing that can play out over years, isn't it?
Exactly.
How many Catholics love orthodoxy? which was written, the book Orthodoxy, which was written before Chesterton converted to the Catholic faith, right? Many years before.
That's a great example. Yeah. Great example. And Elliot's conversion was a long, slow one as well. I think in the past people looked at it as a sudden thing, but it wasn't. It was many years in the.
That's the evangelical belief in conversion. It's the lightning strike, and for some people, it happened. It happened to St. Paul,
right?
But it doesn't happen to everybody that way.
Yeah. So at the end of the Wasteland, you have a momentary reference to the journey to Emmaus in the lines, "Who is that third who walks beside you?" And I do not know whether a man or a woman. Which is a weird other thing that he throws in there. And then he gives a footnote to that passage and throws you off the scent a little bit more by saying that what he had in mind was Shackleton's expedition to the South Pole. But what he's remembering is that at the end of the Shackleton expedition, there were three guys who had to cross over an almost impassable mountain to get from one side of Elephant Island to the other where there was help. And they couldn't sail around. Their boat wouldn't make it. Mm-hmm. So Shackleton and two other guys made this trek. When they got to the other side, one of them said, "You know, I always had the feeling that there was another person with us." And Shackleton said, "So did I." So Elliot's thinking of that experience, connecting it with the experience of the disciples on the road to Emmaus on Easter morning, and suggesting that, yeah, there's somebody else walking along with you.
Are we being too, or maybe appropriately, so postmodern in reading things back into a poem like that, knowing that the later Eliot is this Anglo-Catholic Christian, and so then we read The Wasteland and can we put things there that aren't there? Can a writer, you think, in your opinion, are there going to be things in a poem like that the writer did not consciously intend, but they're there nonetheless?
Absolutely. I think everybody who has thought about it much realizes that not everything that's put in any piece of writing is conscious. And I think Eliot was chewing on these issues. But this is, I think it was fairly conscious. He also has some lines in that section of the poem that seem to recall Christ at Gethsemane. And the crucifixion. I think he was aware of it in this case. I think he knew that he was putting Christ into the end of his poem and suggesting, and this is Christ at the resurrection.
And it's the wasteland of a Christian culture anyhow, so there's going to be elements of that floating around. I mean, there's got to be. Like, we have ideas today that are just secularized Christian morality, thanks maybe in part to Jacques Maritain and talk of human rights, but nonetheless, yeah. We have that where a lot of people will say they believe in a particular thing or a right, and they don't quite know why.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes those rights don't make much sense if they're not grounded in something deeper than the fact that I think the right exists, or it ought to, or the government gave it to me.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How about we have a few minutes left, and let's talk about the four quartets, the more explicitly Christian of Eliot's two famous poems, if we could. Maybe
yes.
Have an example or two for us on the four quartets, which you say would speak more, I think, clearly to somebody new to Eliot.
Yes, I'll give you just maybe one explicitly Christian line from the Dry Self Ages, the third of the quartets, where he says, "The gift half guessed, the mystery half understood, is incarnation." And I think that's a central line to the whole poem. It's about the experience of the incarnate Word in our world, the experiences we have and half understand or half guess of the transcendent becoming immanent, of being among us. So all the beauty in that poem, and it is a very beautiful poem, is ultimately divine beauty. He hears voices in the leaves of the tree in the first of the quartets, and it's not clear what those voices are, but there's always a sense throughout the poem of the spiritual world coming into our world or being in our world. I'd like to, this is a little bit different subject, but we've talked about progressivism, and I think that he addresses that in the Four Quartets in a very interesting way too, especially the progressive history that was being written at that time by H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells wrote this book, The Outline of History, published in 1919, and it was very popular, but it took a Darwinian, materialistic
I think humanity doesn't appear until several hundred pages in.
That's exactly right.
It's a history of the world.
Because that was his conviction, that humanity is just another species that arose out of the evolutionary process. But the aim of Wells in that book is a progressive aim, to show that we've now reached a stage where we can get rid of religion, get rid of tradition, all this superstitious nonsense, and we'll be able to achieve a rational society where there won't be any war, there won't be any disease, there won't be any hunger. Everything will be beautiful. It's the apotheosis of that foolish liberal utopianism. And Eliot encounters that, I think, in the poem, again, in the Dry Salvages section. He says, "It seems as one becomes older that the past has another pattern and ceases to be a mere sequence or even development, the latter a partial fallacy encouraged by superficial notions of evolution, which becomes in the popular mind a means of disowning the past." I think he has – this is an argument that I've made anyway, that he has H.G. Wells's Outline of History in mind when he writes these lines. It was a book that was opposed not just by him but by Chesterton and Belloc very vehemently on Belloc's part.
Yeah, so in my – I teach a Christian View of History class. It's called at Aquinas, and I don't have the students read Wells, but I do – they do read The Everlasting Man. And which was also a response to Wells, but a much friendlier one than Belloc's, which was famous and even infamous for its opposition to Wells and the arguing back and forth. And it's a very important argument, isn't it, that what we have today is all that matters, and we're this much smarter and maybe even morally, if not biologically, evolved than our ancestors. So there's really nothing that's gone before matters, and. But that's still even a far cry from the pure materialists who would just behave like an animal, and that the past doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be somebody's past, so the future doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So I just live for today, right? It's sex and food, and I'm like an animal. That's all that's all we exist for, and that's. Let's try to end on a high note.
Yeah, let's see.
what can we do in our last minute and a half? I should repeat that you are going to be at Aquinas College on Thursday, April 9th, in the Wege Ballroom at 7 p.m., giving a paper presentation called Beyond Politics, T.S. Eliot and Christopher Dawson on Religion and Culture. And usually at our Catholic Studies Colloquium, we have a noted scholar comment on the presenter. In this case, instead, though, we're going to have me, and, since I teach that class on Dawson, and I'll be there too. And I hope our listeners will come to that. I think it'll be enjoyable. In our closing minutes here of Faith and Reason at Holy Family Radio, I want to thank you, Ben, for coming and talking about T.S. Eliot and Christ and culture, politics, the whole.
I'll give you a little cheerier line from the end of Four Quartets, if you like. He quotes Julian of Norwich, the medieval mystic, and says, "All shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well."
Okay. And our wellness, I guess, is in eternity ultimately, right?
Exactly.
That's the message.
Right.
So. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. As always, I'd like to thank my producer, Michael Fiorenzo, for all his help, and our technician, Ben Muldering. I hope you continue to support and listen to Catholic Radio. Good afternoon.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Panero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.